Welcome to Put Simply, the podcast that puts what's happening in the world simply without compromising on the details. Erdem Koç is my name, and as always, I'm joined by my co-hosts Rodney McCune and Ozan Ibrahim. Gents, wonderful to see you both again.
Good to be with you.
Well, US President Donald Trump has done what he said he always would, and that is, well, effectively start a full-blown trade war, particularly in North America. Last week, he announced tariffs would be imposed against Canada, against Mexico, and against China. He now says he has his sights on the European Union and the United Kingdom as well. Let's start with the basics here in the spirit of putting things simply on this podcast. Ozan, what is a tariff and how does it work in terms of the orders that President Trump has signed in the US?
Well, I'm glad you asked that, Adam. It's been a while since I've done first-year economics, but and I say first-year economics because it's really actually quite simple when you talk about tariffs. It's a tax. It's a levy. It's a fee, whatever you want to call it, on basically products that are exported or imported out of a country. So to give you an example, if you're importing a bicycle from China due to or as a result of President Trump's actions, that bicycle will now cost 10% more. And that counter to what's being said, and Trump himself has been saying this, that he's going to charge this on foreign governments, etc. Actually, when you import a bicycle in the US from China, the person that pays for that is the importer. And then the importer pays the 10% extra levy on importing that charge, importing that bike. And then once that's done, they have a very simple decision as to whether they pass on that 10% to consumers or they decide to absorb it. Either way, it's not a great outcome because if they pass it on, obviously that bicycle will cost more for the US consumers. But if they decide to absorb it, that then means that their profits are impacted. And that's obviously for many small businesses that are the backbone of any economy, quite a significant increase in or a decrease in your bottom line and your margins being impacted. So saying that, though, I mean, it's not tariffs have been considered at times useful tools. And it is effectively an economic tool and has been used as such in the past. And if it is used in a way that that makes sense, so for example, if you are trying to build a local industry and you want to make sure that people buy the products that you produce in that industry, and you want to encourage people to manufacture within that industry or into that industry, countries have in the past used tariffs to discourage people from importing in those products, so that local production is encouraged. That doesn't seem to be the case here, because we don't seem to have a very thought out plan around what industries, etc., the government is looking at boosting or trying to encourage. But yes, so basically a tariff can be a good thing, can be a bad thing, and it's not objectively bad, basically.
So we've seen retaliatory action from Canada, who imposed the identical tariff back on the US. China's sort of taking suit as well. Mexico has, by all accounts, had a productive discussion with the US president, and those tariffs are now on hold for a month. Rodney, give us a sense of what is Trump's end game here? What is he actually trying to achieve with targeting these particular countries and then perhaps eventually the EU and UK as well? And what do you see in terms of your analysis of whether this strategy will actually work or not?
So I'd first of all, I don't think he's doing it in order to support domestic production or to benefit American consumers, because he's already talked about short-term pain. He was elected off the back of a promise to do something about the cost of living, which he criticized the Democrats for neglecting. And he's clearly not going to do that if he imposes tariffs and co consumers have to either absorb the cost of imported products, or what has been the outcome in many situations is when you remove external competition because you place a tariff on it, the cost of domestic products moves up anyway. So first of all, he's not doing it to, in my mind, he talks about trade and balance and so on, but it's not to create a better circumstance for American consumers. And of course, it's not something paid by foreigners, which Ozan has dealt with, but he persists in that lie. For me, it's really about coercive diplomacy. So he's trying to use trade or use the ability to harm another country's economy to get them to comply with non-trade related policies that he wishes them to pursue, and to become much more of a vassal state or a satellite state or compliant to American wishes. So when he talks about trade in Mexico and trade in Canada, he doesn't talk about anything other than immigration and drugs, largely. And those are the policy areas he wants those governments to move their positioning to where America would prefer them to be. So for me, the tariffs is really about threat. America's done it before. They did it with Hawaii on sugar 150 years ago. They reached a trade agreement on sugar with Hawaii. They then, when it came to renegotiate it, Hawaii had pivoted their entire economy, and exports to America on sugar had gone up fivefold. The economy was dependent on it, and they said, "Okay, you want to extend this trade deal? We'd like exclusive rights to Pearl Harbor." And that's no different than the type of conversation that they're having with they would like to have with Denmark over Greenland, or they're threatening Panama, or they're threatening Canada and Mexico in terms of illegal immigration. So it's a form for me, of course, of diplomacy. It's unusual because countries don't usually do it in such a blunt and unsophisticated fashion, but EU has historically, or in recent years, tied trade agreements to human rights conditions with potential trade partners in South Asia and East Asia, and so on. China has done it with recognition of One China policy and so on, or offered better trade arrangements to countries who don't warm to Taiwan in a diplomatic sense. So this stuff isn't new, but it feels very blunt the way America's doing it, and they're doing it in such a way that reciprocal type actions by some of the countries are trying to move to a space where they would prefer them to be, has a huge risk around it, that it just sparks off a genuine trade war. Because what if they ask is too costly for those countries, and America is approaching this by saying, we'll have a trade war and it's going to damage both of us, but it's going to damage you more than me because I'm the bigger beast, and therefore you must comply. But it may well be that someone at some point decides to call their bluff. We do then engage in some tariff war, and everyone ends up being a loser. So it's a bully tactic. It's a form of coercive diplomacy. It has worked in the past, so it's nothing new. But the way America's doing it on this occasion through Trump feels very blunt, very unsophisticated, and probably carries a higher risk of getting populations in some of those countries' backs up in a way that they then pressure their own leadership to stick two fingers up at Trump when he makes these types of threats to them, irrespective of the consequences.
I think it's worthwhile breaking a few myths here. I think, the number one myth is that, that somehow the US has been disadvantaged or taken for a ride because it has a trade deficit with many of these countries. Now, we need to be very kind of clear here. A trade deficit is not the same as a budget deficit, and you'll see that a lot of countries have trade deficits with certain countries, particularly considering if you have a country that has high level of purchasing power, it means that they have a booming economy or a strong economy that relies on people importing things and satisfying strong demand. For example, Vietnam has a trade surplus with a lot of countries, including the US. And that, again, does not necessarily mean that's a great thing, because Vietnam and the US are very different countries. Vietnam probably doesn't have the purchasing power within its population to be purchasing a lot of products coming out of various different countries. What it effectively means is that they're exporting more than they're importing. And it could also mean that because they're exporting a lot of things that they manufacture, it's a manufacturing-based economy. So maybe a lot of their domestic demand is being met by what they're actually manufacturing. So, you know, the US has turned itself in the last few years into a country that relies heavily on cheap-made products to meet strong demand. So if people are happy to pay 30, 40, 50% more for products, then you can easily change that trade deficit to a trade surplus, or you can reduce your trade deficit. But those products need to come from somewhere. And if you're not producing them locally, or if you want to start producing them locally, then they're going to cost a hell of a lot more. So again, very basic economics, but completely missed by many of the people who are pushing this. There's a famous, or as the saying goes, if you put 10 economists into a room, you'll get 11 opinions. But I've got to say that I'll be hard-pressed to find one economist who thinks that this is a good economic policy. And to Rodney's point, a lot of this is bullying and it's political. But again, these are very, very silly ways to get what you need and what you want. But Trump, being the amazing person that he is when it comes to communicating things, is already running around saying that he's had a win, because both Mexico and Canada have decided to put more effort into the border patrols and actions on border, etc. But if you take a deep look at that, Justin Trudeau, Prime Minister of Canada, has basically just emphasized something that he had already launched in December last year, ahead of Trump taking office, which was $1.3 billion extra for the border. So he's not given anything new as such. And Mexico has really, really increased its efforts to patrol the border and deal with the border issue in the last 18 months. So again, they're not really doing anything all that new, but it's just mastery communications by Trump. He's running around saying that, look, my tariffs threats worked. And I think we need to really kind of point that out, that actually, no, these people, it hasn't worked. And this is just a stupid way of getting headlines. But what it's doing is it's really damaging the economy, because you look at the stock market, you look at economic, you look at general sentiment economically, etc. Everyone is now expecting some sort of significant economic downturn. So this is bad politics. It's bad policy, but it's just Trump.
Yes and no. Canada and America made those changes in advance of Trump coming in to try and feed the crocodile, right? That was the whole point. That they made that additional investment in order to try and satisfy what they knew was going to be a complaint of his. What I did find interesting with Trudeau, there was the Mexico's been paused for 30 days, and now Canada has actually as well. But Trudeau made this plea to Americans that they've stood with them at 9/11, on the beaches in Normandy, in Korea, and Canadians have always stood alongside Americans and, being one of their greatest allies and so on. I don't think that cuts any ice with the MAGA crowd. I don't know what you make of it, and I don't know whether you saw that sort of speech, but this appeal for historic sentiment just cuts no ice. That's exactly what the MAGA crowd are complaining about. that these
Zero.
other countries have got preferential treatment because of some historical relationship. But we're now in 2025 and they've all got to pay their way.
Completely agree. I think it's zero traction with the MAGA crowd and his base. People are not sentimental about this stuff. And coming back to your point, it is like feeding the crocodile. I mean, both Mexico and Canada, particularly Canada, foresaw that this would be a problem, and they announced significant investment in December to boost their efforts on the border. And what exactly that's what's happened, that they've just highlighted that they made that announcement, but Trump's again masterfully able to run around and take a victory lap because, he's been able to say, look. And rehash basically a story that appeared in December last year, where he's able to say now, my tariffs made Canada increase their investment into the border. So yeah, the Democrats need to wake up basically, because Trump is a master at this.
The only risk at the table is that someone does engage in a proper trade war with them and it has some significant adverse impact on the US.
How much can you argue that this is Trump's mandate? I mean, he wasn't, this didn't catch people by surprise. He was very clear that he was going to, wage a trade war, or at least impose tariffs on countries that weren't coming to the table in terms of what he wants out of those countries, whether it's foreign policy or economic policy or something else. I mean, he was kind of elected on this mandate, like to sort of now come and say, well, this is outrageous. I mean, I would argue, and playing devil's advocate here, that ultimately this is what he took to the election. The American people overwhelmingly voted for him. We don't even have the argument that, well, he didn't win the popular vote and therefore the Electoral College is rubbish. I mean, he won the popular vote as well. The reality is that people in America, the overwhelming majority of people wanted him, wanted this, and we now have it. And so, I mean, in that sense, I don't, is it really bad politics or is it good politics?
So is the question though, I mean they were promised tariffs, they were promised a freeze on immigration, or stricter immigration measures that they would slow down or cease the flow of illegal immigration on the southern border. What they might get is the threat of tariffs positioning themselves better in terms of the overall immigration flow, but not tariffs themselves. And the threat of tariffs wasn't what was promised in the election. Actual imposition of tariffs was the promise and the undertaking. So it may be, and we might say tariffs aren't a great idea, but it may be that people are feel a bit cut short because those tariffs are now subject to negotiation in order to secure some external or third policy change, which might have also been part of the manifesto, but they're not getting both. They're getting one as a device to secure the other, which wasn't what the promise was during the election. The promise was better measures against immigration and the imposition of tariffs.
The promise was to punish other countries who had been taking advantage of the US for a very long time by stealing their manufacturing. The promise was that tariffs would ensure that, that manufacturing jobs, we would start to make, or the Americans would start to make products in America, etc. Like, that was the promise. So by using tariffs as a negotiating tool and faking some victory or success, in some sense, is bad politics, because, it's probably better politics than actually going ahead and implementing the tariffs, because all that's going
Because there'll be no return of manufacturing and there'll be a spike in
to
prices, right?
I mean,
Can I just
costs
say
of
for the just for
all
the
products.
record, did Ozan Ibrahim just say that Trump engaged in good politics? Like, can we say that or?
He's full of praise for Trump today.
Well, I mean, you've got to give it to him. He's a master at deception. So that's yes. But look, again, people were fed a lie. I mean, it's just basically, it's tariffs will fix everything that's been wrong with your life for the last 4 years. That's what the message was. And now, when you go ahead, and if you go ahead and implement tariffs and have a trade war, that's going to be detrimental to most of his voters. And if you don't do it, then what's happened to all of the manufacturing jobs that were supposed to come with tariffs. So, you know, it's not great politics because it's, you know, at some point going to come back to bite him. Not that he cares. I mean, look, he's got 2 years to leave his legacy. And at the end of the day, I don't think he has any interest in seeing a successor go through or anything like that. So, you know, I think we get a little bit stuck on, is this good for Trump? Is this not good for Trump? But quite frankly, it makes no difference. I think we've got to start talking about what's good for the world economy, what's good for the US economy, what's good for the American, you know, for US citizens. Because at the end of the day, you know, it's his politics might be great, but these policies are terrible. I mean, you know, a trade war does not help anybody, particularly considering that, you know, if the real issue here is a flooding in of fentanyl, I mean, this isn't the first time that the US has declared war on drugs. The war on drugs has been going for 40 years. Before fentanyl, it was cocaine, crack, etc. At some point, somebody's got to sit down and say, well, there is demand for drugs in the US. There's no demand. There's no fentanyl crisis going on in Mexico or Canada for that matter. So you know, we're talking about really stupid tools to fix what is a really horrible, horrible problem, social problem. But you know, we're not talking about getting people off fentanyl. We're just trying to restrict their access to fentanyl. And you know, if anyone knows anything about addiction, you know, cutting off supply doesn't fix the problem. It's just going to lead to more crime, etc. No one's talking about better health services, better support services, social services for people to actually wean themselves off, start a new life after fentanyl addiction, many of whom probably went on to fentanyl from their oxy addiction, which they probably developed from, you know, legitimately and legally prescribed painkillers 10 years ago, 15 years ago, when doctors were handing out OxyContin it was going out of fashion, like it was basically candy. So these are the problem. I mean, if you want to fix the fentanyl problem, putting a tariff on Canada and Mexico is about as dumb a solution as you can come up with. It's a particularly considering that, you know, I understand Mexico, about 20,000 kilos of fentanyl was seized at the border last year by Border Patrol. But 19 kilos, that's 19 kilos were seized between the Canada and US border of fentanyl. So that's what the tariffs are there for, to stop 19 kilos of it coming in. I mean, this is just absurd.
Erdem, I think we'll have to pick up the war on drugs as an entire separate thing. But I do think restricting supply on a population macro basis does have a positive impact. But I take your point, Erdem, that on an individual basis, addiction solved in other ways. But yeah, I think we'll have to have a completely different thing on this. And, you know, we criticize Trump for the bully stuff, but maybe we forget very, very easily that, you know, if you can't be both, it's better to be feared than loved. And that's certainly how he's perceived in terms of his knee-jerk and significant threats on trade and so on to get other people to comply. So I'm going to say that he's having a decent week, despite the markets, despite the chaos, despite what some people might feel on the ground. He's actually getting ticks against what he said he was going to do, certainly from Mexico and Canada. Panama's next, and then we'll see how he gets on with Europe. In terms of, no doubt, an increase in defence will be the big ask there, to avoid a trade war.
Well, even beyond that, I think, you know, using the crash between the helicopter and the plane in Washington, D.C., which was, you know, the worst sort of aviation crash in the U.S. For a very long time, and saying at the podium at the White House press room briefing that this was as a result of some of the diversity policies employed by these organizations, and that, you know, that was to blame, and then sort of backflipping on that very quickly and say, well, that's not what I meant. I'm just saying, you know, we don't know the real cause, etc. You know, using these opportunities to generate headlines, to outrage the media, to outrage the left, to me is just classic Trump. And he did this in his first term. He's doing it in his first couple of weeks of office. We are seeing this flooding of the marketplace. And by the marketplace, I mean sort of the media and social media and public discourse. He is flooding it with outrageous claims that generate headlines and that have people like us talking and have people like us doing podcasts and looking into it. It feels like there's been more activity in these 2-3 weeks under Trump than there was with 4 years under Biden. I mean, is that a fair view to push, or is it a communications problem that the Democrats had under Biden and that Trump is just a master at?
I think you've hit the nail on the head, Adam. I mean, there is no doubt that what we're seeing here is you know, throwing everything at the wall, see what sticks, flooding the marketplace with all sorts of crazy stuff. Some of it not so crazy, others really crazy. And confusing everyone as to how to kind of oppose it. But I was listening to the Focus Group podcast by Sarah Longwell and the Bulwark guys a couple of days ago, and they'd done some focus groups. And you would expect many people, these are Trump voters that they focus group, but you would expect many people to go, wow, there's just a lot of noise and, you know, it's a bit chaotic, etc. And the sentiment seems to be quite the opposite. Like, people are really enjoying the fact that someone's out there doing stuff and communicating it, even if for people like us, some of the stuff that he's doing or saying makes very little sense. And I think that's just, to me, that is very informative, because it goes to show what happens when you spend 4 years of having a president that was basically absent. And people can do the autopsy on why the Democrats lost, etc. But you don't need to look very far beyond basically Biden's absence to see why Trump was able to effectively rebuild his brand, rebuild his movement, because he just filled the vacuum that was created by President Biden. And I think there's a lot of lessons there for communications professionals that you can't leave the field vacant. You've got to be out there talking. And, you know, it's people seem to be, even though it's chaotic and crazy, people seem to be happy that Trump's got off to a good start and he's doing things and he's talking to people and he's out there. That's very telling.
Yeah, the sad thing for the Democrats is they know very well that the failure to communicate was vacating the field, but the balance that they must have had was the risk of communicating was even worse. And that says a lot about the decline of Joe Biden during the presidency. And certainly also points to the capacity of Kamala Harris to fill that gap during the presidency, or the willingness of Biden to use her to do that.
Well, to me, I mean, it was we've spoken about this before, but the ignorance of the Democrats to think that Joe Biden's the only Democrat to beat Donald Trump and he can be the only Democrat that would ever beat Donald Trump again was just outrageous from such a long way out of the elections to hold that view. It gave Donald Trump the opportunity to build the brand. And here we are talking about all the things that he's done in just the first couple of weeks. And interestingly, to see what influence this will have and his actions and his policies and his demeanor will have on international politics in other countries. I mean, we're already seeing debates in countries like Australia, which are getting prepared to go to the polls later this year, or in the first half of the year rather, of the right and you know, the conservative movement sort of gaining momentum and using some Trump language and, you know, some of the divisive language that he uses around immigrants and whatnot, whether you subscribe to that view or not. It is starting to sort of come into the arena, if you like, the public discourse. And it'll be interesting to see what impact it has. The country, of course, to next go to the polls is Germany, which will happen on the 23rd of February, sort of snap elections that were called there. Rodney, what's taken shape and who is likely to win, and what would the outcome of the election be according to sort of the polls and the public opinions that's happening at the moment?
Well, there's obviously some disparity on the polls, but what we can say is that Schulz isn't going to win. and the SDP are highly likely to come third. And therefore, it's a contest between this CDU, who are narrowly ahead of the far-right AFD. There's various polls to say how big or small that gap is. The recent one I saw was as close as 2%. But interestingly, in terms of public opinion, the choice for Chancellor has Alice Weidel, the AFD leader, further ahead of Mertz from the CDU, and again, streets ahead of Schulz. So it looks like a very good election for the far right in Germany. And of course, we know that following his Roman salute, Elon Musk then made an appearance at an AFD rally and was telling people they shouldn't be guilty for the sins of their parents or grandparents. So this whole revisionism on the far right in Europe continues, aided and abetted by the likes of Musk. And that rehabilitation and sanitizing of being able to support these far-right parties seems to, it's reaching its conclusion. So, and, you know, it looks like, and the CDU, of course, if it is a coalition, have set aside this 80-year-old convention that nobody would share power, enter a coalition with the AfD, or cooperate with them. So it's quite possible that they will find themselves in government in a few weeks. They may not hold the chancellorship, but it's also possible that they will. And the one thing that we all know from polling related to far right parties is there's that silent voter who may not disclose to the pollster what way they're going to do, but in the secrecy of the ballot booth, they're happy to mark their pencil for the most extreme candidate they can find, and then go home and say to their friends and family that they voted for the moderate. So the idea that the polling is so close might also mean that there's a few extra points available to the AfD when it comes to election day, barring some catastrophe over the next couple of weeks. It's going to be a very good election for the far right in Germany. On that good news point, Ozan?
Well, I mean, you know,
I say
the good
news
keeps rolling in, really. Look, it's no surprise. I think, you know, very similar to the border issue, the immigration issue in the US, Germany obviously has been struggling with its own immigration issues and has, by all accounts, not managed that issue all that well. You know, there's ongoing economic challenges. There is a big debate around military spending and aid to Ukraine, and Germany's role in combating Russian expansion or plans to expand, etc. So there are many issues that are, again, very easy issues or very suitable issues, I may say, to simplify and turn into great populist messages. Many of these issues are already at the top of mind for most voters, and you know they lend themselves very neatly to be turned into messages that are going to resonate with the general population. So I have no, to me, it's no surprise that the right wing party is doing really well. I think we discussed it last week on the podcast that the centre left and the centre parties really need to take a good hard look at themselves around the world to see how they can remain relevant to voters.
And it'll be interesting to see what outcome or the outcomes influence or impact across Europe, as of course Germany is one of the key countries in that region. And speaking, of course, of Europe, the British Prime Minister is heading to Brussels in what is an iconic moment. Rodney, tell us what's going on.
Yeah, it's the first EU Council meeting a British Prime Minister will have attended post-Brexit. Obviously, there's a discussion that Labour have found a reset with Europe as the means of saying that they're going to re-engage again, but not either join the customs union or indeed join the EU. But there is a desire to have some better cooperation. And that, of course, is polling in the UK suggests that most people think that Brexit now was a bad idea. But that doesn't mean that there's a a majority of opinion to say that we should be re-engaging. But where there are, certainly with Ukraine and Russia, areas of desire for cooperation, which are pretty popular around trade, but also around security and spending on defence and so on. So the UK is back engaged with Europe, although not in Europe. Europe is finally post-divorce. They're happy to be a little bit more amicable in terms of how they're reacting to the UK. Scholz was at, though he's, as we said, not likely to be there in a few weeks' time, was at Chequers at the weekend prior to the meeting to have some time with Keir Starmer. And this will be some sort of retreat in a castle in Brussels that the EU leaders are all getting together for. So it's good that UK's back involved. They found a way to re-engage with Europe. Ironically, it's on defence to an extent, which is one of the issues which drove Brexit, the fear of an EU army, and how things have changed in terms of the perception of is it a good idea or not to cooperate with our European neighbours on defence. But there you go, that argument's clearly moved on and that perception's clearly moved on. So yeah, it's good for Starmer. He is starting to set a pace of what direction he's going. He obviously has to deal with Musk and the right criticism, but it does feel like they're less lost than they were a few weeks ago, Labour, and perhaps they're starting to hit their strides. We'll see a little bit more leadership from the UK government over the coming months. And of course, in the meantime, which I'm sure Ozan is pretty happy with, we find that JD Vance and Rory Stewart have started to have a bit of a spat. Why the Vice President of the US feels the need to argue with a podcaster and former not senior UK minister, but of course he was a Tory leadership candidate but an unsuccessful one, is beyond me. You're a few weeks into your administration and you feel the need to argue with Rory Stewart. Remarkable, Ozan.
Well, I guess you weren't available to argue with, so he went for the next best thing.
I have a Rory, better IQ score.
I mean, look, for those who probably and hopefully missed the news, you might want to explain exactly what the spat was about, because it was truly bizarre. I've got to say, truly bizarre.
So there's a spat over Vance's view on Christianity, where he was saying that sort of a staged view to loving and kindness and all these, good Christian values towards their neighbors, that there's a hierarchy. You start with your family and then maybe the person at the end of the street and then maybe your community and then maybe the bloke who lives 100 miles away and the bloke who speaks a different language. And we didn't get to the person who didn't look like you, but it felt like that's where this whole hierarchy of Christian brotherhood or love was being set out by Vance. So in a sense, it was still America first, and it was sort of explaining the policy stuff that underpins it in line with his view on Christianity, which Rory Stewart said was nonsense, and said the last thing we need is politicians interpreting the Bible, and it's obvious that this is universal and it doesn't matter who your fellow man is, you show them the same level of compassion and so on. Then Vance, of course, went along the lines of saying that Rory Stewart had a low IQ or a lower IQ than he claimed to have. And I think the figures were something 130 or 110, not 130. And it felt all a bit like Biden and Trump arguing over golf. But then Rory Stewart hit back by saying, well, I hope you're not criticizing people who have an IQ of 110, because that's 75% of the US population and probably one in two of your voters. So it escalated quite well, and there was this sort of to and fro. I know the Spectator ran a piece in recent days to say that Rory Stewart had clearly badly lost this exchange. And they're not a fan of Rory Stewart's. I think they described him in that one as Florence of Arabia, which is quite good, right? But anyway, I think he sort of held his own. I think Vance is the loser to have engaged in some pretty silly territory with someone who had no real, significance in terms of American political life. I think he lowered himself to get involved in that, and in doing so, elevated Rory Stewart in the minds of Americans, and will allow him to platform himself as an ongoing critic of the administration.
This is what happens when you get elected vice president, but someone else, the world's richest man is actually doing a job. So you've got a lot of spare time on your hands to be having these spats on, on social media. So anyway.
It was just a very odd exchange, but it's quite funny, and it certainly had me following social media to see who's going to say what next. I suppose we're going to see a lot more of this, and maybe prominent non-American figures on the center or the I'm going to say the soft right or the center right or even the center left, who are prepared to criticize the American administration. Maybe we'll see more traction behind them than some of the Democrat critics and so on of Trump and Vance and Musk in the coming weeks. Maybe we'll get more of these little exchanges across Twittersphere or X.
Well, I think we should use this opportunity as an open invite to JD Vance if he wants to come on, put simply, and have a spat with us directly. He is very, very welcome.
You know what? If he's busy, I'm happy to argue with him on social media as well. No problem.
Absolutely. I mean, none of us have the IQ levels of Rory, so we're safe.
Or Florence, as we now like to call him.
Exactly.
Let's stay at the level that we want to stay at, gents. Thank you so much for your time this week. See you next.
Thank you.
Thanks, guys.
And that's been this week's episode of Put Simply. Be sure to follow us on LinkedIn at Oroka Group to stay up to date with all the latest episodes and news. Feel free to leave a comment and suggestions on what you'd like to see featured on the podcast as well. Until next time, I'm Erdem Koch.
And I'm Ozan Ibrishim.
Thanks for listening.